Backcountry.com is an online outdoor gear and apparel retailer carrying thousands of brands and products for mountain biking and your everyday outdoor lifestyle. Not only does Backcountry have the widest assortment of gear and apparel, but the heart and soul of the company lies with their Backcountry gearheads. These gearheads are former pro athletes, Olympians, and all-around experts that are available 24/7 by phone, email, and chat for one-on-one service, product recommendations, and to ensure you have everything you need for your next outdoor adventure. Go to www.backcountry.com/singletracks and use the code SINGLETRACKS15 to get 15% off your first purchase. Some exclusions apply. That's backcountry.com. Check the show notes for the link and coupon code.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Single Tracks podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Alistair Backett. Alistair is a mechanical engineer and bike race mechanic based in the United Kingdom. His firm, Redburn Design, helps small bike brands expand their product range through innovative and award-winning product development and manufacturing process refinement. Listeners may be familiar with one of Alistair's most recent design projects, the new 161 Enduro bike from the Privateer brand. Thanks for joining us, Alistair.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So you've worked with a lot of different bike companies over the years. How did you get started in the bike industry?
Yeah, I guess my, like you say, my background is mechanical engineering. And I guess my first big break or introduction into the industry was when I agreed to help a buddy of mine, I guess, acting as a mechanic or driver, whatever way you want to look at it. So I'd spent a lot of time growing up riding bikes with Ben Reed, who lived just a couple of miles away from me here in Northern Ireland. So in 2007, he'd had a really good season and he'd realized he needed somebody to come on the road and help him. You know, he'd had a few different people helping him over the years, but he wanted somebody that he could really, I guess, take on to, you know, full time or whatever way you look at it. So, he asked if I wanted to do that. And I jumped at the chance to go and do that. And I guess that was, my way in, for a better way of putting it, to the industry that we're in today. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, was that after you had finished your studies in mechanical engineering, or was this before and kind of motivated you to get into that particular field?
This was probably, 2 or 3 years afterwards. So I finished my education and I was a bit burnt out with the whole engineering thing at that point, because it was, you know, the college was quite intense. And after that, I just wanted any job really that got me involved in bikes. So I got a job at a few local bike shops and eventually got a job working for Chain Reaction Cycles. And if you coming from Northern Ireland, there weren't really a whole lot of other opportunities if you wanted to work with bikes. So I did that for a couple of years, and then that's when the opportunity with Ben came about. So I think I did 2 or 3 years of work after college, and then I don't know, it was probably around 2007 that Ben and I had the discussion, and from that point I packed up my bags and off we went in a little Fiat Ducato van, and we started driving around Europe and living the van life, I suppose, is what they call it these days, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I imagine you saw a lot of opportunities and got a lot of ideas while you were on the road with Ben, right?
Yeah. Well, I think back then I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I was, if an opportunity popped up to go and travel or learn to be a mechanic or whatever, I was like, yeah, look, I'll give that a go. And I wasn't by any stretch of the imagination a really top end mechanic at that point. You know, I kind of, once I'd agreed to go and help him, I thought, well, I should really try and hone my skills. So I guess I had a couple of months to learn how to do those bits I didn't know how to. But when we were on the road and at the races, you know, as a fan of downhill at the time, like, it was really cool to go and be at those races. You know, I'd only seen them, you know, I'd only seen them on DVDs, you know, on Sprung DVDs or Earth or whatever it was, you know, and I suppose at that stage, like, some of the online websites were really, like, starting to cover the racing as well. But to go and be there and see all the racers and see the trucks and everything, it was a real, like, you know, thrown in at the deep end, but it was really cool. And you know, some of the guys I met throughout the course of the 4 or 5 years doing that, you know, I still work with those guys directly or indirectly now, you know, and you make a lot of connections, you see a lot of things. And it was, I really enjoyed it. It was I guess I was nervous because I wasn't, you know, I wouldn't have I guess, describe myself as a big traveler beforehand, you know, it turned out to be really, really worthwhile, and I'm glad I did it. A lot of the stuff I learned then still stands me in good stead now, with the business. So yeah, good way. And I know, you know, it's funny, I get that question a lot, you know, how do you get into the industry that we're in? And, you know, everybody's story is different, and it's, I don't know how to, you know, how do you offer advice to someone that says, hey, I want to work in the bike industry? I'm not really sure, you know, I just happen to be in the right place at the right time. And I think a lot of people maybe are in, have a similar story. So yeah, tough.
Well, in 2018, you started your own firm, Redburn Design. What inspired you to make that leap?
So I guess my job at the time was changing. You know, the company had just been bought over by its competitor, and I could see a lot of changes happening that I wasn't really all that stoked with. And I guess deep down I thought, well, you know, I guess I was looking for other opportunities, and I didn't know, you know, I've always thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool to have independence and work for yourself? But I'd never, you know, I hadn't really spent any time actually pursuing that. You know, I was just, I was enjoying my work, you know, and, you know, the process that I was going through. But, you know, whenever the company got bought over, I thought, no, this isn't really, you know, this is not looking too rosy for me in the next couple of years. And I guess I wanted to try and progress and keep progressing. I felt like I'd been progressing quite a lot in my career up until that point, and all of a sudden it was as if someone was closing the doors, and I thought, no, this isn't right, so I need to find something else to do. And I guess, you know, my experience of trying to get into, you know, the bike industry from an employee, you know, from a career point of view, was, you know, coming from Northern Ireland, there really isn't a whole lot of opportunity. So I guess a part of me always thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to try and do something yourself and build a business that allowed other people a way in, you know, or an alternative if they wanted to start working with bikes that didn't mean they had to move to a different country, or it didn't mean they had to, you know, had to work for just this one company that existed. So that was a, you know, there were a few, I guess, aspects or elements of it that were driving it. And I just thought, you know what, the time was right. I'd had a really good couple of years. You know, I was working at Nukeproof for the 7 years leading up to that time. And I think, you know, I felt like I'd done a good job up until that point. You know, your first couple of years of any new job, you're very much winging it and trying to learn as you go. Right. But I sort of felt like, okay, I finally think of, not that I've cracked it, but I know what I'm doing now. And I don't know. I just thought, now's the time to go and try something different. And yeah, so I just thought, I'll start my own thing, and I'll try and, you know, I guess do similar roles to what I had been doing. Cause you know, at Nukeproof, I was not, you know, I started as a design engineer, mechanical engineer, but I very quickly then moved into a whole pile of different roles. And because of the size of it, because it was a small brand, you know, you had to wear multiple different hats. And I think that then geared me up. I felt like I had a skill set that I could offer to other companies that maybe needed a bit of this or a bit of that, or advice on this or some design here. So, you know, that was, I guess, the thought process behind it. So yeah, I handed my notice in and started Redburn Design. And I think, you know, from a life point of view, I was, you know, I had a young family. I was, you know, my life had changed in the last, you know, the 10 years previous, where I was kind of young, single, you know, had the scope to go and travel and do all these things. And, you know, life had changed a lot. And I think I kind of fancied a change and a start over.
Yeah.
So that was, yeah, I guess there were a couple of factors, Jeff, that really steered towards that end goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what are some of the most interesting or rewarding projects you've worked on so far with Redburn, or even at your previous brands?
Yeah, well, I guess prior to leaving and starting Redburn, I think the biggest, you know, the most rewarding thing that we'd done was being involved in, you know, when I was at Nukeproof, being involved in, I guess, the whole process of whenever they decided that they wanted to bring Sam Hill on as, you know, one of their athletes. And that was, you know, an incredible process to go through. Having been, you know, like most of us are, you know, a massive Sam Hill fan, you know, to be told, okay, right, he's going to be potentially, if everything goes well, he's going to ride one of our bikes, and he's going to ride, you know, sign for the team and hopefully go and try and, you know, put some really good results in. So that was a lot of pressure for a young, you know, a young engineer who'd only done a couple of years and was quite green to the whole thing. And you know, the process wasn't easy. And, you know, that was kind of one of the first bikes that I'd really, you know, designed from scratch, you know, along with one other engineer. Like, the two of us had really put a lot of time into it, and all of a sudden, you know, they're saying, right, this bike's going to go to Sam Hill to test, and if he likes it, then he's going to sign the deal. And, you know, that was, so I think, you know, and then obviously he went on to have success on that bike, and, you know, that was the team's first, I think it was the team's first actual World Cup win in downhill. So that whole process was really cool to be involved with, but again prior to what I did. But I suppose, you know, since starting Redburn, yeah, I've been involved with a couple of projects that have been really exciting and challenging at the same time. I'm still working on a lot of projects that haven't made the light of day. I guess it's the nature of the cycle industry. There's a lot of things you can't really talk about until they're through. But, you know, I was involved with Forbidden Bike Company, you know, with Owen at the very start of getting that up and running. And, you know, I'm quite proud of being involved to get those guys, you know, or to help those guys go from a design and an idea into a business that was essentially operating and ordering frames and, you know, shipping those all around the world to different customers. So that was quite rewarding from my side of things. And yeah, like the privateer projects have been good as well. It's cool to see guys that, you know, were not involved in mountain bikes, you know, in bike design. You know, they obviously have a background in other products in the same industry, but, you know, to be involved with that and see that reach the light of day, like it's all rewarding. You know, I think most of the projects we work on, I find quite rewarding because they're, you know, you're creating something that didn't exist, you know, 6 months or 12 months prior. So yeah, it's good. I enjoy it, you know, but not every project's as fun as the others, but, you know, you gotta take the rough with the smooth, don't you?
Right. Yeah. Well, do you spend much of your time working with athletes, or is it more with brand managers who have an idea of the product that they want, or is it kind of a combination of the two?
Yeah, I suppose it's a combination. At the minute, it's mostly working with, yeah, essentially a brand or product manager, or depending on the size of the company, it could be working with the boss of the company,
yeah,
depending what they want, you know. But generally, we work with sort of smaller to medium-sized businesses where, you know, like, you don't necessarily have just one dedicated person that is your contact point. You could be talking with their marketing guys, their product guys, their tech mechanics, whatever, you know, so it's kind of interesting. And then if they have athletes that are involved, then you'll have some, yeah, for sure, we have some interaction with them. It's not as much as, you know, and I think, you know, maybe I'm speaking out of turn here for all businesses, but in any engineering department or design department within any bike company, you know, they have a whole fleet of athletes, but I feel like they're a lot of the time underutilized as well. Like,
yeah,
just more so as well, because they're not always as accessible as you would like. That's something I've experienced at a few different companies and in a few different jobs in the past, and I still today, as Redburn goes forward, it's the same. You know, it can be difficult to really get the maximum out of the athletes that are in, really, you know, that are related to the projects you're working on. But, you know, you've got to, it's a global, I guess, process. You've got to speak to everybody and get data from everybody and try and interpret that your own way. So, but I would say a good, you know, the vast majority of my time is dealt with, is spent dealing with product managers or brand managers, whoever that on the project and its details. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Privateer 161. So
yeah.
Privateer is a fairly new brand. Do they have, as like a small company, I wouldn't imagine they would have their own designer or engineer necessarily, right? Is that kind of why you're brought in?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, they already manufacture and retail products in different areas, you know, as far as mountain bikes go, they didn't, you know, they were starting essentially with a clean slate. Now the company's made up of a lot of bike riders, which is it's a good start, but it doesn't mean it's made up of engineers and designers. And I think from their point of view, they wanted to, I guess, get an end product that they felt wasn't within their grasp easily, you know, to start the process of going out and creating your own team of engineers that can deliver such a thing is time consuming and costly. And I guess they're quite forward thinking in terms of, well, let's get the right people that are available and bring those in, and, you know, rather than try and, I guess, hire and upskill within, you know, they do that as well. But I think, you know, it's a clever business. I think it's clever the way they look at things, and they, you know, and it has meant that they've potentially fast tracked the project to production much sooner than they could had they chosen a different path, if that makes sense. So yeah, so they got in touch probably 2 years ago, or not far off 2 years ago, and we started, I guess, communicating on, well, what is the project and what do you want to do and what's the end goal, and that's where, yeah, and you know, Redburn's basically been involved in the in most of the elements of the design and the, you know, all the engineering behind it all. Yeah, whereas, and then those guys, essentially, their background is in sales and marketing and distribution and all the other bits that go with it. So they, you know, they've they handle all that stuff, and I try not to worry about it at all. Which is quite, you know, it's nice as well. You know, coming from a background where you had to worry about everything, now I can just focus on just the bits that they need added to it. Which is, yeah, I think it's a good way to work.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense too, because you know, you don't want to figure out how to design a bike sort of along the way. Like, you want to start with something that's,
yeah,
that's good and have an experienced designer like yourself. So how much of the design is your own thing versus what the brand comes to you with? And, you know, if you can talk about that specifically with Privateer, like, do they come to you and just say, make us something awesome? Or do they say, we've got very specific ideas about, we want the bike to do this, this, and this, and have sort of these broad specs? Like, what? How do you usually start that conversation?
Yeah, and it's very, you know, it's different with each client, I guess, as well. You know, some people have got more of an idea of what they want or what they think they want, and others are a bit more broad. You know, I haven't had someone come to me yet who knows exactly what it is they want and say, this is what we want. You know, nobody so far has said, yeah, no, we categorically, we know this is exactly everything that we want delivered. So, and I guess if they knew that, you know, maybe they could do it themselves. But with the Privateer guys, like, they did have ideas on what was important to them as a business. And, you know, I guess then it was a really good process. You know, I spend a lot of time flying across to the office and spending time with their team, and I guess I got to learn a little bit about the way they operate their business, so I could start to understand what their customer might want. And yeah, they had some interesting criteria that definitely guided the project along. But a lot of it was, okay, well, can you help us fill in the blanks? You know, use your experience, help us fill in the bits that are missing. And then we kind of review that and revise it over and over again. So that, which is kind of how the process went. So they, you know, with the 161 project, they didn't know what travel they wanted it to be, but they start with, okay, we want, you know, relatively long travel. We want a 29er, but it needs to be a bike that can pedal up all day, and, you know, is built for just rallying down. You know, they knew what they, sometimes it's easier to start with what don't you want, and then that kind of eliminates all that sort of stuff, and then you're left with, okay, well, these are the options of what you could end up with, essentially. And then other criteria heavily affect it, such as, you know, your target cost or your target weight or the way it should function. You know, what features on the bike are important to you, and what ones are maybe less so important. And it's not, you're not asking what's less important, but you're saying, okay, well, all of these come with a price, you know, not necessarily a monetary price, but a penalty of time or weight or investment or tooling or whatever it might be. And so I spend a lot of time sharing my experience and knowledge with them on all of those aspects. And then it was almost an exercise of going through, well, okay, if we apply, you know, if we want this feature, well, that's going to add, you know, $50 to the unit price, and that's going to add £150 or whatever, you know, equates to the customer. And do they, if you were a customer, would you rather spend that £150 on that feature, or would you rather save it or spend it in something else? And that was very much the process that we went through with the Privateer team. And they had a really good way of looking at it. They were very much coming from the customer's point of view rather than what I guess a trap I've fallen into in the past, and I think a lot of design departments or product managers fall into, is trying to design a product to fit in with a certain range that you're expected to have because the industry tells you that that's what you're expected to have, or the magazines, they're doing a review and it needs to be this price and it needs to have this tire and it needs to be that amount of travel. So actually they really sat down with me and they said, okay, well, we think this is important to the customer, and this is the customer that we're trying to, I guess, design a product for, and mm-hmm. and you know, this is the problem that we're trying to solve with it. And so it was a nice process to go through, for sure. And we continue to go through that process on further product development as well. And I think it's good because you can start to see them developing a style as a as a company or as a brand that customers will then become familiar with. And, you know, I guess there was no point designing a product the same as everything else because, you know, why bother, you know, making the same thing if you can, you know, if you've got the opportunity to make something unique or different that solves a problem. So that's kind of where that came from. Yeah.
Yeah. With all those constraints and considerations and trade-offs, I mean, it sounds like your job is mainly solve problems, right? Like you just figure out like, how do we do this? Like there's so many competing things that, like you said, you're trying to, you know, keep the weight down, but price has to be reasonable and it still has to perform. And
exactly. And I think that, you know, whether that's just the job of an engineer to be a problem solver, but I think within the bike industry that, you know, that's what you learn. That's what all these larger companies have learned through their process. Nothing, you know, there is no such thing as perfection. You can't just have everything perfect from the start the way that you want it, because there's always got to be a payoff with something else. You know, you've got to weigh up one thing over another, and there's always got to be compromise. And I guess especially for a young company that are trying to get into develop their first bike, you know, without the experience that we brought, you know, there's no doubt they would have got to the end goal eventually, but, you know, how long would it have taken, you know, how many mistakes would they have made along the way? Right. It's not to say that they don't still make mistakes with our help. You know, everybody, you know, we're constantly learning as well as we go, and every new project that we do, I suppose that's part of, I guess, the uniqueness of bringing a company like Redburn in, because you know, we're developing projects for different clients and we're experiencing a whole different host of problems. And hopefully that actually allows us to then broaden our experience and learn, which we can then, I guess, use as we move forward for other companies that might come to us. So that works both ways, I guess. But yeah, it's very much about problem solving. And that's why I think I spend a lot of time at the start trying to really dig in and almost challenge them on their design brief and say, well, why do you want it? You know, you've told me you want the customer to spend this much money on this bike, or you've told me you want it to function in this way. Well, why is that? Why, you know, and I'm constantly asking why, to try and make sure that either they really feel confident that that is what they want, or to highlight that maybe there's an alternative that they haven't considered and it might be better or worse. And so I think that process is good. And that happened very much with the 161, and it, you know, that chopped and changed quite a lot as we went through the early stages of development, and which I think those guys would look at now and go, yeah, I'm glad we did that. I think that was a good process to go through, and it saves you, I guess it's slow and fast out, like any good cyclist would tell you. You know, you got to put the time in at the start and really try and think, you know, 18 months to 24 months ahead. And that, you know, and that's going to help you make better decisions at the start, or put you certainly closer to the right path at the start, which is what we try and do.
Yeah. Well, why did you choose to go with the horsed link design for the 161 over a single pivot or another sort of suspension configuration?
Yeah. I guess the main factor in choosing that design was one of, well, we've got in the design brief, there were a couple of things that were going to be quite, not risky, but progressive. So they, you know, they felt quite strongly that we want quite a progressive geometry. So there was going to be quite a big change there. You know, they wanted to have, you know, different chainstay lengths. You know, weight distribution was important. All these things were starting to add up that were important to them. And, you know, when I said, well, okay, have you got any idea what sort of suspension layout you want or don't want? You know, and that was, they had less of a preference on that. And I thought, right, okay, well, with all of these other things that you're asking of it, if we select a horse link design, that actually simplifies things slightly and allows us to really concentrate, you know, two benefits. One, it allows us to concentrate on the bits that you've highlighted as really important to the end, you know, the end product. Mm-hmm. And it also, I guess, allows or will hopefully allow the customer to feel more familiar. You know, it is a really commonly used suspension right. platform, as we all know. It's used on loads and loads and loads of different bikes. And I guess a lot of customers feel familiar on it. It is an easy bike to get on and feel familiar with versus, you know, something with a VPP or maybe a high pivot bike, you know, where the characteristics when you get on feel a bit alien. With the privateer, you know, I guess we wanted the bike to feel as familiar as it could, because we were going to probably have quite an out there seat tube angle or quite out there geometry, you know, yeah. Reach numbers. And so I guess a lot of it was trying to make sure that let's not create something that's a complete, you know, has too much going on and too many changes, because that might not be the right thing. Doesn't mean that you know, we won't look at different suspension designs in the future, but certainly for this application, it felt like the right way to go. And, you know, it's easier to tune the shock to get the performance right based off that, and, you know, that layout as well. So there were quite a lot of benefits to sticking with the horse link. You know, nobody wanted to do it because it's quite hard to make a bike look aesthetically different. But when you use the same layout as everybody else, that, you know, that was obviously a compromise that was going to have to be potentially made, as you get with any choice, any design choice on any bike. You're going to have to, you know, it's very rare to come up with a bike design that functions really well, has really good geometry, and looks completely unique. There are really not many bikes that do that today.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the varied chainstay links on the 161, and that's not super common on mountain bikes. So what are your thoughts on that, the advantages, and why don't we see more brands doing that?
I think it's becoming more common. You know, the main reason you don't see it is because it is difficult to do. I mean, from a manufacturing point of view, there's a few different ways you can design the bike around it. The simpler way, and the way the 161 is done, is you just physically have got different length seat stays and chin stays. The factories don't like that because it's more tooling, more investment, you know, and that's a decision that the privateer guys had to make. You know, do we feel strongly enough about this to take on the additional investment to open more tooling for all the different chainstays and seat stays? And yes was the answer for them. There are other ways around doing it where you don't necessarily have to do that, but that's all a trade-off. And I think the biggest challenge from an engineering and design point of view to not do that is you've got to essentially design, you know, if you're making four sizes of bike, you've got to design four different bikes because the suspension, you know, the kinematics, everything, you know, it's all levers. And if your chainstay lever is longer on one bike than the other, well, that's going to affect, you know, there's a whole pile of knock-on, I guess, effects. And some of them, you know, sometimes you get a knock-on effect that actually plays to your strengths and works out better off. But I guess with a larger bike with a longer lever, you know, you maybe don't want that longer lever to give you, you know, it's going to affect the shock differently. And so it just requires more, I guess, more engineering work and more customization on shock tunes and that kind of thing. So it just complicates the process. But that doesn't mean it shouldn't happen. It doesn't mean it's the right, you know, it doesn't mean it's the wrong decision. The way I look at it, you know, and I think traditionally when people design bikes, they try and start with, okay, let's get the suspension system dialed in, and then we just make our four different front triangles and away we go. And that is the way that, I guess, for a long time bikes have been done, especially with aluminium bikes, purely because of the way you've got to join all the tubing together. But I think now, you know, weight balance has become more of a prominent aspect of design, and people are, you know, riders are getting more switched on to how important, you know, weight distribution is within a bike and its handling. And the only way to really, I guess, not refine that, but to really get your weight distribution the way you want across all sizes is to obviously change the position of where your axles are in relation to where the rider's center of mass is. So we do it with front triangles. Why not do it with the rear center as well? And so I can see a lot more people adopting it, and there'll be, I'm sure, lots of different ways that people will adopt doing it. But yeah, I still think it is beneficial to the rider ultimately. And it means that somebody that's, you know, an extra large guy at 6 foot plus, you know, is getting a similar ride experience to, you know, a smaller person on a small or an extra small frame, which is the way you want. You know, you want everybody to get a similar experience from the bike or whatever the product is that you're bringing to market.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to know how closely you work with suspension engineers when designing a new frame. Are there like just specs available? Like you go to Fox and RockShox and you can just kind of get all the data that you need, or do you spend more time, you know, communicating directly and really like getting, I guess, support from them, for lack of a better term, in terms of like making sure that everything is optimized and dialed for your design?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you definitely you've got to work with the suspension companies because there's only so many different variations that they can, you know, economically produce and manufacture. Mm-hmm. The way we tend to do it is that we'll come up with a set of kinematics that we think is a really good starting point. We'll then, you know, we'll communicate that. At some point, we'll get to the point where we think, you know what, we've ticked all the boxes, we've done all our clearance checks, you know, the shocks are going to fit, we're not going to have any interferences when we turn this into a 3D model. you know, will then communicate with, you know, the engineers at RockShox or Fox or whatever, Kane Creek, whoever the shock partner is going to be, you know, assuming you know who the shock partner is going to be for that particular brand at that time, you know, there's all these different steps you got to go through. And you'll basically supply them with a, look, here's our initial draft of our kinematics, you know, this is, and you'll give them an outline of what the bike's supposed to be and how it's supposed to ride. And then they'll basically give you some feedback on that and suggest, they might suggest some tunes that, you know, are standard tunes. I guess every, you know, all those shock manufacturers, they've got a set of base compression and rebound tunes that you can generally configure easily. Sometimes if you've got something completely out there, they might need to develop, you know, like a line extension just for your bike. That comes with its own complications because in order, you know, you're asking those guys to invest time in making a product really unique just for your bike. So you've got to make sure you're ordering enough of it to verify all that. So there's all these other complications that as a smaller brand, you don't always have access to all of them, but you've got to start somewhere. So with the privateer, you know, we kind of worked closely with RockShox at the time and tried to, I guess, work out, yeah, okay, they've made some suggestions on tunes that are available. And I guess technology as well, as it moves on quite quickly, you know, new options become available. So like I've got quite a good relationship with the guys at RockShox in terms of shock tuning, you know, from previous jobs, and that definitely helps you get to a better point, you know, a better starting point essentially. But I guess a lot of it, you know, comes down to the feel that the brand wants from that bike. You know, some, you know, might have two completely different riders or two maybe journalists that are both reviewing the bike. They might both feel different things. They might both ride in different ways and want different things from that bike. So I guess that's where the job of a product manager comes in my experience, to define the ride characteristics of their frame that they want. You know, and it might not be perfect for everybody, but, you know, you need to feel, and this is something that I learned at Nukeproof. You know, we had to really decide, well, what's important to us, what way do we like to ride, and what way do we hope that our customers will like to ride, and then you design a shock tune around that, and the only way to do that is really is ride testing the bike over and over on different trails with different shock tunes, and I guess trying to validate, yeah, this is what we thought is correct, or no, we need to make some changes. But, you know, the guys at Fox and RockShox they specialize in this. They're so good at it. And over time they begin, you know, you build a relationship and they start to know, you know, your preference in terms of riding style or what you expect from the bike. And they can almost, you know, without even having seen the bike or ridden it, they can, you know, 9 times out of 10 say, do you know what? I think this tune's going to work for you. And you go and test it. And, you know, they'll throw a few dummies in there as well, just to make sure you're not just saying yes for the easy life. But generally it is a very much a two-way working relationship to get the best out of it. But, you know, I would say, like, shock tunes and shock technology is evolving so quickly that it's quite it's important that you have that relationship. Otherwise you could end up with a bike design that's based around an old shock. You know, I say old shock, the shock might be a year old and it's already been replaced by something that's improved or better, or a new way of tuning it has become available, and actually that would have worked really well for this project. So yeah, it's a never-ending search, I guess, for performance.
Yeah, you make a really good point too about understanding the customer, the rider that you're trying to target with a particular bike. And, you know, I know plenty of journalists who I respect, and I know they're great product testers, and, you know, they'll say, wow, this bike is amazing, I love this bike, and I'll ride the same one and say, I didn't really like it. But that's not to say that they were wrong and that I'm right. That's just to say everybody's different shape and size and has a different style, and all of those things contribute. And so, yeah, really understanding who you're going for, I think, obviously you're going to be more successful.
It's like that discussion about, you know, designing bikes for World Cup athletes, you know, and if we design the best bike that we can for that World Cup athlete, well, you know, there aren't very many customers that are expecting the same performance from their bike as Aaron Gwynn is or Luke Bruni. You know, so if you design everything based on just what they want, well, you're going to end up with a bike that isn't always going to work that well for the people that are, you know, working hard to pay to buy those bikes and prop your company up. So you've always got to balance that somehow. And doesn't mean you ignore what the World Cup athletes do. You know, they're pushing the product to, you know, beyond the limits quite often, and I think it's important to gather that information. But yeah, I guess in my experience, you've got to be mindful of who's the person that's going to buy the bike and what should they, or what, you know, what do they expect from it, and what would benefit them. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, switching gears a little bit, I want to know how you feel about long, low, and slack enduro bikes. And obviously, everybody wants a bike that's going to, you know, climb well enough and descend really well. Are there certain parts of that trifecta that you think we can keep pushing in terms of getting, you know, longer or lower or slacker? Or are there some of those that are probably pretty good where they're at right now?
Yeah, I guess in my opinion, you know, you're always going to have these outliers that try and push things. And I think that's a good thing because it allows other people to sit back and observe and go, well, they've pushed it pretty far. I'm not sure, you know, but, you know, if everybody sat and didn't push the envelope, you know, you wouldn't get anywhere. Eventually, you know, it would take you a lot longer to get to the end goal. So I think that's good. I do think, you know, in my experience, I think we reached this with downhill a couple of years ago. When I was at Nukeproof, we tried a lot of different things, and I think we reached the sweet spot in terms of geometry with downhill. Enduro being, I guess, a younger sport, and the development is obviously much more rapid because the demand, you know, the sport's growing, the competitive side of it's growing much quicker, and I guess it's a step closer to mass market as well. You know, with bikes that, you know, you or I would go out and it's the bike you would spend probably, you know, 90% of your time riding. In terms of geometry, I don't know if we've reached the limit of or the optimum that's there yet, but it's hard to define. That's where I think the weight distribution for me, that's where weight distribution comes into it. I think that, you know, in your question earlier about chainstay lengths and balancing front and rear centers, I think that's an area that more and more people will start to really, you know, and I guess it's like Formula One, when you get to that upper level of speed and capability, it becomes more and more about those little small marginal gains or whatever. Yeah. You know, and I think that's where engineers will start to go now and really refine the smaller pieces of performance because they are becoming more and more important. And I mean, personally, I think the weight distribution side is quite a big, you know, it's quite a big importance to get that right. Mm-hmm. So that should be an easy one for engineers and designers to jump on. But yeah, in terms of geometry, I don't like to say we're close to the end with it all, but I think it's getting harder and harder to, you know, make bigger advancements. You know, I don't think head angles need to get any slacker. We've tried that. We've been there. It's not necessarily for everybody. You know, you don't need to look too far past the top, you know, Enduro World Series riders to see what they're riding to realize that they're not all asking for slacker and slacker head angles because, you know, they you reach a point again where it becomes, you know, diminishing returns. It's not, you know, there is a sweet spot of compromise. But I think those bikes definitely being closer to what, you know, the majority of customers ride because, you know, you can ride all day on it. It's capable of riding downhill tracks from not too many years ago. And, you know, it has to be quite a versatile bike. So I think that potentially limits where you can go in terms of geometry, I guess, if that makes sense. But I do think it feeds into the other aspects of cycling as well because of the development has been so rapid, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, you mentioned how downhill bikes have kind of found that sweet spot, and yeah, I mean, I've noticed too that the geometry just hasn't progressed a ton on that side, but it seems like enduro bikes are getting closer to that, you know, like we're kind of getting up against that, especially when you look at head tube angles, they're really not far off between enduro and downhill at this point. Do you see that? I mean, what does that mean? Does that mean that downhill bikes are something that we could actually just use for enduro, or is it the other way around that people can just ride their enduro bikes and compete in downhill?
Well, I guess you know it's been a couple of years since I've been at Whistler Bike Park, but you know that used to be, you know, the standard procedure used to be get your downhill bike, ride it for a couple of months, book your trip to Whistler, you take it there, you have a great time, you know, and then you come home again. Whereas now I would have thought, you know, the majority of the bikes on the trails at Whistler are enduro bikes because they're so, like you say, they're so close in capability to downhill bikes. They're not the same, you know, otherwise the guys racing downhill World Cup, they would be on, you know, the bikes that the big companies want to sell, you know, they'd be on their enduro bikes, and that isn't the case. So there is obviously, you know, a huge performance gain in the downhill bikes, but obviously the compromise must be too big to say, well, why don't you just race your enduro on a downhill bike? And I think from a design point of view, there are huge, you know, the fact that on an enduro bike, you have to be able to put a full length dropper post in there. You have to be able to do all these things. And on a downhill bike, that's less important. So that frees up on the CAD model to tweak things for a downhill bike that you can't necessarily do. You know, you're trying to fit more standard parts on an enduro bike, and that puts its own challenges in place, I guess. But yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, enduro bikes were the first to play with wheel size and get up to 29 inch wheels. And then we started to see that into downhill. So that, I think that aspect is definitely influencing downhill. And that's where we've seen the more recent changes. Like you, I think you mentioned, geometry hasn't really changed a whole lot in downhill for a long, long time, other than wheel sizes coming, you know, changing. And I think that was probably driven by, well, first of all, driven by cross country guys who wanted 29 inch wheels years and years ago, and then driven by, you know, enduro, but because, you know, the downhillers could see that all these guys were racing pretty much, you know, not far off the same speeds, in some cases the same riders, you know, that were racing downhill and enduro, and they could see, well, hold on, if this is making my life easier to race on enduro, well, why would it not make my life easier for racing downhill? So I think the two do influence each other, but yeah, I think enduro is definitely still got a way to go in terms of what's capable in terms of development, I think.
Yeah. Well, if you were going to make your perfect bike today, what material would you use? I know there's a lot of debate about that. Is, you know, is carbon better than titanium or aluminum? And also, how much travel would you want on your own bike design?
Yeah. I'm not sure there's a perfect bike out there, is there? Like, you know what, and I guess, like, you know, you touched on earlier, everybody's different, so what might be important to me might not be important to you, and vice versa. I think it's a tough question, you know. Materials,
you must have a preference. You must be like, I'm a titanium guy, or no, I like carbon fiber because it's, you can do cooler stuff with it.
Yeah, I understand and appreciate a carbon bicycle frame, and I understand, appreciate an aluminium. I think if I'm entirely honest, I would love, you know, if I could do it, and if budget was no object, let's put it that way, I would probably design an aluminium frame. But I would, you know, budget would need to be no issue, because I'd want to tool up for everything. You know, it would all need to be shaped. And, but, you know, purely from a longevity, you know, whenever I've not had many carbon frames in my lifetime, but when, you know, when I have done, I'm just so nervous about, you know, the surroundings that you're going to use this product in. You know, it's sharp stones, it's rocks, it's trees, it's all these things. You're going to crash, you're going to damage, you know, and that, I guess, you know, carbon is really, really brilliant at a lot of things, but, you know, when you don't have to go too far to watch a Formula One race on a Sunday afternoon and you see somebody, you know, contact, and that's the wing gone, and that, you know, if that's, I think for competition at the elite, you know, most elite level, definitely, you know, carbon probably has a lot more benefits to it at that point. But from a purely functional basis, which I guess I'm coming at less so aesthetics, but purely functional basis, you know, it feels like there's less benefit to be had with carbon. But, you know, the guys standing in the bike shops trying to sell the bike, you know, they know that it's going to be easier to sell this bike that's, you know, made of carbon and it's painted with a fancy color scheme and it's got this spec. You know, there's more to talk about and that, you know, so there's, again, it's, I don't like to use the word compromise, but there's, you know, there's a lot more aspects to the whole industry of manufacturing and selling bikes. But, you know, back to your question, I would have an aluminium bike, but I would probably make it look like a carbon bike, if that makes sense. I can't tell you why. That's just how I think. But I am excited as well about the new technology. Like the additive manufacturing side really excites me in terms of bike production. And I think that opens up a hell of a lot of opportunities that haven't fully been exploited yet. And that's an area that really interests me. And it's got, you know, it's got a long way to go. And I think that, to me, feels like, you know, what's this space that you're going to start to see companies really get behind that and create products and bikes that you've never seen, you know, things that you couldn't, you can't make in aluminium or you can't make in carbon because of the, just purely the process to make them. And I think that's where we're going to see, certainly not so much from a volume point of view, because you can only, you know, you can only print so many bikes in a day, but you know, that technology is definitely exciting, especially now that they can print all these different metal materials. So
I think
if I didn't make an aluminium bike, I would probably print something for myself.
3D printed bike, That's going to be awesome.
Yeah, with a couple of different shocks. Yeah.
Cool. Well, are there any bike frames or other products that you're working on right now that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, there's a project that I've been working on probably for 7 or 8 months now that hopefully will see the light of day in the next couple of months. And it's again it's bike frame related, but the manufacturing method for that is very different to traditional methods. Again, I can't really say too much about it, but it's quite exciting, and it's, I guess it's popped up loads of challenges in terms of how we've been working with the client to design the product, because you can't just apply the same logic of, well, okay, is it a carbon frame? Right, it's made this way. Or is it an aluminium frame? It's made this way. You know, this is kind of like a hybrid technology, and you know, you got to manufacture it a certain way. So that means you then have to design it a certain way. And you then, you know, as much as it throws up challenges, it throws up loads of opportunities too. So that's been quite exciting to sort of, like you talked about at the start, problem solving, you know, trying to figure out, well, hold on, how do we put cable guides in this thing if we're making it this way, and how do we do all the, you know, that yeah, it's I can only say so much, but when it does come out, you know, I think it'll maybe make sense at that stage.
Is that being driven by cost, or is this more of a performance thing, if you can say?
I think it's being driven by a desire to manufacture something in a certain way because it can be done in a certain place, rather than following the traditional methods of, you know, boy starts bike company, boy flies to Asia, finds factory, makes, you know, that it's basically saying, okay, if we don't do that, what other ways can we do it, if that makes sense? And that, so that's then driven the design process and driven the design brief. So, but you know, you're still I say this a lot, but you're still trying to make a bike that fits the same set of hubs and wheels and fits the same forks and the same shocks from all these different manufacturers. So you've got to, you know, there's obviously quite a few fitment points that you're constrained by, but you know, the spaces in between and the way you manufacture it, well, that's up for grabs. So if you can find a new way to do that or do it differently, well, then that's fair game, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, are there any bikes or product designs that you've worked on in the past that you sort of now shake your head at and say, wow, what were we thinking?
Nothing really jumps out. I think when I, like any engineer, you probably look back at something you did a couple of years ago and think, oh, I don't like that anymore, and I should have done that. But, you know, you're constantly learning. So what you learned in the last year, 2 years, 3 years, obviously, you know, you could then apply that to a product you designed 5 years ago and it would be far better. So occasionally I'll look back at previous projects that I've worked on or I've delivered and think, oh, why did I choose to do that? Or why is that, you know, but it doesn't make them wrong. It just, they, I guess they were right for the time or right for the ability that I had at the time. But there's nothing that jumps out completely hideously and thinks, I did think it was odd. When I was at Nukeproof, we designed a little sloop style frame, and the athletes at the time, they all wanted their shifter not on the handlebar so that they could do bar spin. So we designed a little bracket that you could put a time trial shifter on the down tube and bolt it all in. And now looking back, I think, I can't believe we spent so much time on that, but I guess it's probably still applicable maybe in some aspects.
Yeah, that's what you get for listening too much to the athletes, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Huh. Well, are there like sort of dead ends that you've reached, or, you know, kind of paths you went down and it didn't work out for whatever reason that kind of stand out?
More so with certain manufacturers, I guess. Some projects that I've worked on in the past with clients, you know, you go so far and they've been dead set on, no, I've got, I already work with this manufacturer, I want to do the project with them. And you kind of go, okay, well, let's go down that path. And then all of a sudden it gets to the point where the project becomes, you know, it hits a dead end, it hits a roadblock, and, you know, either the factory's unwilling to budge on whatever they need to budge on to help manufacture that particular product, or they've just changed their mind and said, no, we're busy now, we don't need your business, you know, and that then requires the project to have a full step change. It might require a redesign, or, you know, and that can often be a tricky conversation with a client, because they're, you know, they're saying, right, we want you to design this bike, off you go. And, you know, at some point you might hit one of these walls, and then it's a case of, well, okay, you know, we've just burnt 6 months on a project, we're gonna have to start again potentially, or at least for a part of it. So that those, we have hit a few of those in the past, but, you know, we've so far we've always managed to figure out a way around them, and actually in most cases, it's ended up being a blessing and we've ended up with a better end product. You know, either we find a better manufacturer or we've got a, you know, a clever solution to resolve the whatever the issue was at the start. So, yeah, it's not without its own challenges, I guess.
Yeah. Well, as sort of a contract designer right now, do you get to ride a lot of prototypes, like early stage stuff, or is it usually the brand that's doing that, or their athletes?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. The I guess it depends how hard we push with them, and there's, you know, there's money tied up as well in prototypes, and that's often.
Yeah, it's got to be expensive.
Yeah, and if you're working with a, if you're working with a smaller client, you know, it can sometimes be tricky for them to say, you know, we're like, we've got to order four or five prototypes of this first, you know, especially when you're doing your prototyping in Asia, which most smaller companies would do. It can be tough, but certainly with the privateer guys, like I've been testing prototypes throughout the process, and especially when it comes to working on the shock tunes and that kind of stuff. Sometimes, you know, sometimes they'd rather do it themselves, or you're working with a client and they say, no, we know what we want, and you tear on. And, you know, if that's their decision, that's their decision. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I do. It is important for the people that are involved in the design project to get hands on with the product. And I have experience of this in the past where, you know, even before Redburn Design, when I'd worked with other consultant companies and design agencies, and we maybe hadn't given them prototypes early enough, had got their feedback, and, you know, those are all things that I guess I've learned from and try to apply today. That it is, you know, the not so much the more opinions you can get, the better, because we all know what happens when you get lots of opinions. But, you know, sometimes, you know, just giving it to the right person can be invaluable, even if it's not the feedback you wanted from them. It allows them to at least understand, oh, actually, I could shave some weight out of this part, or I could tweak this part of the design that would make it better for the next bike or for this one. You know, there's a lot of that goes on. So yeah, getting your hands on a prototype is important, because that's where you do your refinement. That's where you see things for the first time in the flesh. There's no substitute for looking at a frame and holding a frame. You know, it's not the same on a CAD screen. Everything just looks different that way. So yeah. It is fairly critical to get hands on, and if you can spend some solid time riding the prototypes, then that's even better.
Yeah. Well, I imagine in Northern Ireland you probably have some pretty good trails for testing prototypes. What's sort of your go-to spot for that?
I wouldn't say we're the R&D mecca of the bike world by any means. It's a fairly small island, but I guess it's typical of the UK, I guess, like slightly smaller hills. You know, we make it count when we have to. There's a couple of spots that if I've got a bike and I want to try and get familiar with it, I'll go to like a local forest near our house, mm-hmm. not because it's a great test track, but just because I go there all the time. It's familiar. You're not learning the terrain, you're learning to feel the bike. So you get an initial, and you know, no bike feels good at that particular forest. I don't know what it is. Every single bike feels horrible there. So I don't know if that's a good test ground or not, but I'll generally go and ride there. It's 10 minutes from my house. We actually moved to be closer to it just before Christmas. And then there are a couple of bigger mountains about an hour further south, right on the border between Northern and Southern Ireland, down in the mountains of Mourne. So there's a couple of good tracks down there that they have some events on. There's a Red Bull have a fox hunt every year. Mm-hmm. Well, they used to have it every year. It actually hasn't been on this year, obviously, but there's some good tracks where that event happens, that there's a shuttle service and everything up there. So yeah, quite often when you've got a new product, I'll try and go midweek and sneak out some laps in there. But you can, it's easy to test a prototype here because there's no media, you know, there's not much of a scene here. So right. I think that when I talk to other designers and engineers and product managers in the mainland of England and Wales and Scotland, I think it's a bit harder for them sometimes to test a prototype, because there's always some journalist on the trail who's having a sniff around and go, oh, what's that? Yeah. So over here you can ride past anyone, they'll look at it and go, oh, what's that? No, they're more worried about getting a pint of Guinness at the end of the day. They don't care so much about what bike you're on.
Anonymity has its advantages.
Has its benefits. Yeah, for sure.
Very cool. Well, Alistair, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. I really learned a ton, and yeah, we're really stoked about the designs that you're working on.
Awesome. Wow, thanks for having me, Jeff. Yeah, it was good fun to talk.
Well, you can find out more information about Redburn Designs on the website, redburndesigns.com. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.